Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, talking about invasive plant species today. They're a serious threat to native plants and certainly maintaining a healthy diversity in our natural areas. And we need to do what we can to control. You know, I don't think some of them we're ever going to get rid of, but hopefully we can control them. And I have a couple of guests for you today who can answer some questions about doing just that. Kelly Kern's been with us a number of times. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation Program in our Wisconsin DNR. And Kelly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And Mark Rentz, first time for him. He's an associate professor and extension weed scientist at the UW and UW Extension and the Department of Agronomy. And Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Longtime listener. Glad to be here today in person.
Well, it's great to have you here. And, you know, and first, invasive, you know what? Somebody said, well, what the heck's an invasive species? Somebody asked me that this morning, Kelly, and I said, well, why don't you listen and let Kelly explain it?
Okay, well, invasive plants or invasive species are species that generally are not native to an area, so they've come from some other part of the world, and they cause either ecological or economic harm or possibly harm to human health. And usually they're things that will, once they get established, they're really hard to control and they just take over and outcompete native species.
Yeah, and Mark, are they really any different from the plain old ordinary weeds that we have?
Well, that's a great question, and I would argue, you know, hearing from a weed scientist, so obviously I'm going to say they are quite different. A weed is just simply a plant you don't want growing where you want it, a plant out of place, as that many of you have heard. And these invasive plants have very specific criteria, as Kelly mentioned. One, they're not native to the area that they're placed, and two, they're causing or have the potential to cause some type of harm. You know, those two factors are really what differentiate it from many of our just weedy species in general.
And we have invasives pretty much all over the state, Kelly?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. A lot more in the southern counties, but there are definitely some in the north as well.
We have, we actually have a list, do we not, of what we consider to be the worst characters?
Right. So in 2009, we established the NR40, which is the invasive species rule for the state. It took us about 5 years to put it together and get a lot of input from the public to make it as accurate as we could. And we put it together originally. We intentionally left off a number of species that we knew would be or were higher use ones, things that were being used on a regular basis for agriculture or as ornamentals. But we also knew that they were invasive, or also ones that we really needed to have more information on. So in 2009, the first rule went through. And then as of May of this year, we revised that and added a number of additional species as well. And so now we have quite a few species on there that are ones that are used in ornamentals, as ornamentals, or for other purposes. Some of those, however, we actually have exemptions for certain cultivars. So, for example, Japanese barberry is on there because it's highly invasive in certain areas. But we only listed the top 25 weediest of the Japanese barberry cultivars. And so the other cultivars that we did not list are still available in the trade.
And so you could actually buy them at an establishment.
Right. And we actually, when we revised the rule this time around, we even put in a phase-out period to allow nurseries to continue selling the plants that they have that were added to the list this time around so that it doesn't really impact the nurseries as much. So you can no longer import them into the state. So like if Walmart's buying them from, you know, bringing them in from Arkansas or wherever, they can't bring them in anymore. But if they're already growing in your nursery, then you can continue to sell them for 3 years for herbaceous plants and 5 years for woody plants.
There we go. You had a Facebook question from Bradley who wonders why you have the water hyacinth as an invasive plant. He says this plant has no chance of surviving northern winters.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we've gotten a lot of comments on that one. When we first assessed this plant back for the 2009 list, then we didn't have any evidence of it overwintering, and we didn't think that it would be able to. And the same with water lettuce, which is also another floating aquatic plant that's typically used in water gardens. Since that time, we've had several years that we have found evidence of both of those species overwintering in Wisconsin.
So they are living.
Yes, in inland waters and also in the Mississippi. Mississippi River. And so they have overwintered, and they reproduce very, very quickly once they're established in an area.
We have lots of callers online. By the way, if you have a question as we talk invasive species with our two guests today, Kelly Kearns of the DNR, Mark Rentz of UW Extension, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or again, post on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title to get there, just type in The Larry Mueller Show, and you can get right there. Arlene in New Berlin has been waiting a bit. Arlene, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. I wish you could see my the southwest side of my property. They'd all be laughing. I looked up Canadian thistle from Penn State, and I also looked up garlic mustard. Did you know those roots go like 17 feet horizontally and 20 feet deep on the Canadian thistle?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, because mine have, the Canadian thistle has the heads on them, yet they haven't flowered yet or busted the seeds. If I cut them down with a chopper, I have to hand cut them all down because they're intertwining with my evergreen trees. How good is corn gluten during the spring and the late in the fall to apply? I bought some from Home Depot, and you attach a hose to it, and then it covers 2,000 square feet of plant, your garden. And if I use it, will it kill the roots on my evergreen trees and anything else that's kind of intertwined with all these? And I'll take my answer off the air.
And you've got a bunch of garlic mustard as well, correct?
Oh, yes, but I cut the heads off because there was at a program that said, somebody said between May and June to cut the heads off. So
yep.
I went out at the end of May and I cut them all down, but I don't know if they're going to come back or not.
Oh, they'll probably come back for a while, won't they, Mark?
Yeah, so first we'll talk about the garlic mustard. I think you're right on. Garlic mustard is a biennial. It reproduces by producing seeds. And if you can prevent that seed production for multiple years, you can effectively suppress those populations. The challenge is with garlic mustard, those seeds are usually coming in from other sources like squirrels, rodents, wind, water. And so that's the challenge. And so an easy thing to do is to pull them or to cut the stems right when they're starting to flower.
Yeah. So that's a good, and you know, you're going to cut it back.
Yep.
You're going to have some success.
Yep. It's a numbers game, right?
Yeah.
You know, one plant can produce thousands of seeds. And so if you can reduce the number of seeds you create in an environment over time, you're going to cut back those populations. So that's an easy solution to do. The Canada thistle is a little bit more of a harder solution on that one. And so in that environment, to directly answer your question, is the corn gluten meal probably isn't going to do anything for controlling your Canada thistle, but it won't harm your trees if you put it out there. Corn gluten meal works well on small annual weeds that have small seeds, and Canada thistle is a perennial with this large creeping root, as you mentioned, so it's just not going to work. And so I don't think it's worth your time and energy to utilize that as a management tool.
So what do you use then?
Well, you know, you do have some options, you know, and the options are really specific to the environment they are. It sounds like this is growing nearby and adjacent to trees, and so you have very limited tools there. I think your idea of mowing them right now, right in that flower bud stage, which they are right now, is a good time to mow them. That will not control them, but that will knock them back. And then when they regrow, you have some options on what you can do. Herbicides is one of those options, but you have to pick those herbicides carefully so that you don't harm those tree species there.
Yeah, there you go. Some things to think about, Arlene. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
And Arlene, one last point is we do have a really nice fact sheet on Canada thistle that you can get at the Learning Store that details all these control options and has effectiveness. So if you look that up, that's available.
So you go to the UW Extension Learning Store, learningstore@uwex.edu, or just put in UW Extension Learning Store, and it's going to pop up, that's for sure. I think we even have a link on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page to the... We send people there a lot.
And often if you can just Google Canada thistle, Wisconsin, it'll
pop
up.
Yeah. Yep, there we go. Joanne in Winneconne Question. Hi. I don't know if we would consider Creeping Charlie an invasive, but what's your question, Joanne?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, we have a lawn with a lot of Creeping Charlie. It's kind of gotten out of control. And we're wondering, is there any natural remedy that's non-chemical but effective? And number two, if not, what would be the most natural remedy we could use to control our Creeping Charlie? Thank you.
All right, thanks. You know what I do, what I've done, and not on this lawn. I've given up on the lawn I'm on now, but the previous house that we had, I wanted to keep it back. So my daughter was 9 at the time, mm-hmm. or 8 at the time, and we would go out on the lawn and hand pick.
Yep.
And it's a bunch of work, but it was a lot of fun, the two of us. And you'd be surprised in a half hour or an hour, especially in an hour, you can make a big dent and never have to apply fertilizer. I mean, it's going to come back regardless.
Yep. No, I agree. And Kelly, is Creeping Charlie native? I believe it's not native to Wisconsin, too. So it is, could be categorized as an invasive plant. And I call it one of the most well-adapted plants to Wisconsin because it really does do well in this environment and this landscape. As far as natural remedies, you're really, really challenged. I think Larry hit it on the head is doing some hand pulling can have some success. In any type of lawn system, I would say the first thing to do is cut your lawn at the correct height. Make sure you're cutting it at 3 to 4 inches. Yep, so that'll keep it nice and competitive. That'd be one. Two, proper fertilization, because keeping that lawn competitive is really going to keep that Creeping Charlie out. And what it does, and Larry, you can back me up, when you have a competitive lawn, it's a lot easier to pull those plants out.
Absolutely.
Than when you have a really low-growing lawn that's not very competitive.
And so, and there, you know, the chemical means there, you know, typically fall is the time when you'd be doing it, maybe right after that first frost.
Yeah, exactly. Any of those broadleaf herbicides registered for grass work very well, and we recommend any time in the fall, I say after the kids go back to school, is the time you should start be thinking about doing it. And you can get up to a year, year and a half of suppression out of it. That would be the recommended time if you wanted to go down that route.
But I tell you what, it's a lot of fun. Get out there with the kids on your hands and knees for an hour or so, and you can make a big dent, and it's surprising how much you can pick. Ned in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ned. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for doing another show on invasives and native plants. I do a lot of work with native landscaping, and one of the things that I found to be troublesome in the May and June months up in Green Bay is identifying which grasses that are coming up are native and which are invasive. And, you know, long before they get their seed head or their maturity, it's been pretty hard to tell sometimes in my gardens which ones are
which
popping
is
up
which.
That are, that, yeah, which is which.
So, so you're looking for a resource.
Right. I don't know if the catalog that's online, if that, you know, if they've looked at doing some of those earlier pictures or any, if there is any resource for some of that, the earlier time in the growing season.
Yeah, well, Ned, we have this great online tool, if you're web friendly, called weedid.wisc.edu. And what you can do when you go there is you can enter certain features of that grass, particularly for weeds, horticultural species, and that will help come up with a list of pictures that can help you with identification. And for the grasses, they're taking pictures of the seedlings as well as the developing stems before they have flowers. So if you have some botanical skill, like do you know what a ligule or an auricle is, Ned?
No.
Okay. So, and we have some help buttons on that too. So you might want to visit that website. That might be a good resource. There's a lot of other agronomic resources that if you wanted to send me an email, I could send you links to that. Some of those are at the Learning Store and some of those are not, just to help with identification. But it's hard. All right, Kelly?
Yeah, grasses are hard. But one thing you may want to do if you have the same grasses that keep coming up year after year, is allow a couple of them to go to flower and then collect them and make your own little herbarium specimen of it, so that then you'll know next year you can look at it and say, oh yeah, that's the one that, you know, turned into brome and I want to get rid of it, or that sure. one is one of the natives and I want to keep it.
And Ned, I would, just as a plug, say we have an excellent county agent, Vijay Pandian, in that area. If you have some species you're not aware of, you can certainly contact him or any other county agent, send off samples, and, you know, they have very well trained in identifying them, and they can help identify those specimens. And if they can't, they send it to me. And if I can't identify it, I call Kelly. So we have a really good network here in place to get these things identified, and that's our goal, because that's the first step in management, right? Knowing what you're dealing with.
Right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, talking today with Kelly Kearns and Mark Rentz about invasive species. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, many of us are looking forward to summer vacations, and Kathleen Dunn and her guest will talk about the benefits of taking earned vacation time. That's a hard thing for me to do sometimes. I know it might be for you. So listen in at 2 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, dealing with invasive plant species with our two guests, Mark Rentz from the University of Wisconsin, Kelly Kearns of the DNR. Cindy in Belleville up next with a question. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I'm needing some advice on how to eradicate oxeye daisy from my pastures. It's awfully pretty, but I understand that it's spreading a toxin into the soil that will suppress other grasses and forbs, so I need some help with that.
Mm-hmm. So, Cindy, I work quite a bit in pastures, and you know, I've not heard of this toxin that you mentioned before, so I'm just kind of curious if you could give us a little more information.
I don't remember the name of it myself, but I recently heard that if you get a substantial stand of the daisy, that you'll find that other grasses and forbs, broadleafs, are being suppressed. I wish I knew the name of it to tell you.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there are a range of options for management. In a pasture setting, you know, if it's widespread like it sounds like, and is this for horses or for cattle?
This is for sheep, actually.
For sheep, okay. So there's a range of options. It's not a toxic plant to the sheep. So one option could be is you could try to promote the sheep to eat it, and that will give you some modest suppression. It sounds like that's not something you just want to really get rid of it. Another option would be to use a broadleaf herbicide, and there's a wide range of them available. And oxeye daisy is fairly sensitive to these herbicides, and so if you could make an application of one of those broadleaf herbicides, and there's a range of them, that should give you some effective suppression. The downside is, Cindy, that if you have legumes like clovers and alfalfa in your pasture, those herbicides will harm those legumes as well, and so there's definitely a trade-off.
Yes, yeah. Mowing, I hope, is also an option. The sheep will eat the flower heads, and they will ignore the stems, so I have been mowing it after they go through.
Yeah, mowing will help, but it's really not going to get rid of that plant. You know, it is pretty prolific once it gets established in those pastures, and so that's going to be a challenge. You know, the other option is just to wait till it gets really bad and then disc up that pasture and replant it with some new species if you didn't want to use herbicides. But it's a challenge once things get really well entrenched. You know, that's really why often our goal and what we like to promote is detect these things early. You know, if you could have gone back 5 or 10 years when you just had a couple little patches, it would have been a lot easier to get rid of, wouldn't it have?
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. I was just wondering if oxeye daisy produces juglan.
No, I believe it does, and I'm guessing that it's some sort of allelopathic response that she's referring to. We do see it in a lot of our pastures, but I've seen it in a lot of pastures with still very, very healthy grass stands, and so I'm not sure how bad it is really for those grass stands. I think we need to look at that a little more.
Karen and Jefferson up next. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi, Larry, Kelly, and Mark. I just love this program.
Thank you.
Well, I love Garden Talk, too, and about 4 or 5 years ago, I called in a question about the wild parsnip. And I'm referring to the kind that can burn your skin and has yellow flowers.
Yep.
Okay. At that time, I had seen a few between Janesville and Madison, and I thought, I was concerned because I thought, oh, are they going to get here someday? Well, they're pretty close. And I wanted to know at that time if they would cross with Queen's Anne's Lace, which I believe is Wild Carrot.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so they're in the same family, you know. And they said, no, that would never happen because they don't bloom at the same time, and left it at that. Now, I was wondering now, since this year, for some reason, one might be blooming late and the other is blooming early. I'm not exactly sure, but I know what Queen's Anne's Lace is, and I have some. And, you know, I will be yanking it out and maybe putting it in a vase. make the best juice you can. But anyway,
all right.
So what is the answer, since we've got them both blooming at the same time, and I do not know that much about botany.
Okay. So both wild parsnip and Queen Anne's Lace are the wild kind of escaped cousins or siblings, I guess, of the garden parsnip and garden carrots. And the garden varieties are much more cultivated so that you get a really good root. However, both wild parsnip and Queen Anne's Lace, the roots could be eaten, but they're kind of scrawny. They're completely separate genera or genus. And so it's highly unlikely that those two species would cross. It's not because they're flowering at different times. It's because they're just not closely related enough that they would cross. Generally, species are designated as an individual species because they won't cross with anything else. There are exceptions to that rule, but for the most part, species will not cross with another species.
I don't want to have to worry someday that I have a Queen's Anne's Lace that's going to burn my skin.
You probably will not need to worry about that.
All right.
Unless there's some wild parsnip hidden underneath them.
and wild parsnip is blooming right now in southern Wisconsin. So if anybody does have a patch of wild parsnip, now is really the time to be mowing it. Get it now while it's still in flower and mow that back so that it doesn't produce seeds. That's another one of these biennial species that it will die after it produces seeds. And so the goal is really to stop seed production.
But remember, if you do mow it, to be careful, because if the sap gets on your skin and hits sunlight, you can get a very bad burn. So just have some caution when mowing it.
Yeah. Long pants, long socks.
I had somebody on the show not long ago whose daughter has gotten nailed 3 times with it, and every time it was painful. She said, you'd think she'd learn. Tina in La Crosse.
I'm sort of following up, good morning, on the wild parsnip. I know you can eat stingweed, and there's certain things that one part's toxic, the other's not, or if you heat it or cook it, things are edible. So you can actually go out, dig up the wild parsnip, and if you don't mind it being a little fibrous, it is edible as a parsnip.
Yes. However, you wouldn't do it this time of year. You would need to do that in the fall or in the spring. So you'd get those plants. So the first year they put out a rosette, and they develop that big rosette. And parsnip is actually a monocarpic perennial, meaning it may live for several years before it sends up its flowering stalk. But once it's sent up a flowering stalk, that plant is putting all of its energy up into the top, and so the roots are going to be really scrawny. So you really want to do that in the fall, like maybe even after a frost.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have open lines again, finally, so you can join in, too, with your weed question at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Kathy in Littleshoot, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for having this show. I love it. I have a question. I know purple loosestrife is invasive. What about the yellow loosestrife? Is that the same thing, only a different color?
There are a number of different species of loosestrifes, things that are called loosestrife, and Lithrum is the genus for the purple loosestrife. And then there's Lysimachia, which is a genus for several of the yellow loosestrifes, some of which are native and some of which are not. So the Lysimachia that is not native and is invasive is Lysimachia vulgaris, the garden yellow loosestrife. So that may be the one that you've seen. And that one actually can sometimes even outcompete purple loosestrife. There's also a related group of species, the Lysimachia numillaria. That's the moneywort. It's the small ground cover plant that has like nickel-sized leaves that grows kind of on water in really wet areas. That can also be quite invasive in wet areas and floodplains. And both of those are listed as restricted species under our NR40 rule.
There we go.
Years ago, I picked this yellow loosestrife in my mother's garden, and she is long gone. And so I have it in my garden, and when I share flowers, I give some of that away. So now I know I better not, right?
Yeah, and especially don't give away the plants. You know, don't dig up the plants and share them with your friends, because then they might have problems as well.
There you go.
Oh, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot, Kathy. Appreciate your call very much. And Sean in Wausau, what's on your mind?
I bought a house a couple of years ago, and there's a stand of Japanese knotweed. And I've seen this in a couple other spots, maybe within a mile or two, that there's big stands that are starting up. And I'm having a real hard time getting rid of what I have in my yard.
All right. How do you get rid of Japanese knotweed?
Well, you know, this is actually a great question, Sean. We've actually been researching this exact question for the last 3 to 4 years, and I just want to preface it by saying not easily. So
figuring out.
Yeah, so maybe describe a little bit more detail this property you have. Is it an urban area? Is it next to houses? Is it in, you know, a grassland area?
What we bought was a house out in the country, a small yard. There was a stand of this knotweed. It was probably about, I don't know, maybe 20 feet long by 10 feet wide. And the first year we let it go, thinking, oh, this is kind of neat stuff. Well, then the next year we decided we didn't want it. They were going to plant flowers, and so we tried mowing it. And that didn't fix our problems. And this was 3 years ago, and I'm still pulling up shoots as through the summer. If it rains, it seems like it puts up shoots. And we've sprayed it. We've done everything. I can't get rid of that stuff.
Yeah, and so, I'll just reference, we have an excellent fact sheet on this at the Learning Store, and if you can't find that, you can email me, and I'd be happy to send it to you. But really, we rely on this as really vigorous root systems and is really rapidly spreading, and we're really concerned about these species. And so how we recommend management is a two-step process. We recommend mowing it right about now, and it can be pretty tall. Sometimes it can be upwards of 6 feet tall by now. Letting those plants resprout, maybe mowing them again, and then letting it regrow again in September, again, this fall timing like we talked about with Creeping Charlie, then that's when we recommend spraying it with systemic herbicide. Okay. And we can, depending on the herbicide, get 85 to 95% control 1 year after. So you're not going to get rid of it, but you're going to knock it way back.
Okay. Is there a way that we can mechanically remove it? How deep are these roots going?
Deeper than your foundation. Actually, in Europe, this plant, they're actually have put a moratorium on houses for sale that you cannot sell your house if it's infested the property with Japanese knotweed because it goes underneath and through the foundation. So the only non-chemical method that people have had some limited success is tarping for 2 to 3 years, and that has seemed to give some decent suppression over the infested area. But it's a big suck of time to do that, and then you can't utilize that area for 2 to 3 years.
Sure.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Sean. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Bert in Greenfield. Hi, Bert. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I've planted a prairie behind my house. It's about a quarter of an acre. It's been there for about 6 years. And now I have an overabundance that's almost taking over of Canadian goldenrod.
Canada goldenrod.
Okay. So this is a native species, and unfortunately it's a very aggressive native species. This is one of our species that's super invasive in Europe, where it's gotten into Europe, and they have a lot of problems with it there. Fortunately, we have a lot of insects and other things that do feed on it here, and so it's not quite as bad here. In a prairie, one of the things that can be done when you have a very dense stand of it is to mow that area down in midsummer, like probably right before it's starting to flower. And that'll really knock back that goldenrod if you do that a couple of times and allow other species to come in. It won't get rid of it. Again, this has a very substantial underground root system, but that is one way to deal with it. You could also use an herbicide on it, but you need to be really selective because that herbicide would kill pretty much the other herbaceous species in the area.
Yeah, I mean, there are some herbicides that would not kill some of the native grasses, but any of the forbs would be damaged by it. So that would be something you could look at. And there are a range of species of herbicides that have some pretty good effectiveness. But I would echo what Kelly said, to really be selective with that treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what if I cut it back to about a foot and used a herbicide?
I would just either do one or the other. I don't think it's really worth doing both do that, too. I know that a previous gentleman on this show has created a really unique protective area around a nozzle that really limits where that herbicide applies, and he says it works just wondrous on suppressing things like goldenrod. So if there's lots of grasses surrounding that goldenrod in the understory, I would choose one of the broadleaf. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's basically a lot of forbs, and they're starting to crowd out the forbs, and the forbs aren't coming up now.
Yeah. So another, and this is I want to emphasize, a very high labor-intensive method, is you can take garden shears, dip them in a 25 to 50% solution of glyphosate Roundup, and cut individual stems. And so when you're doing that, you're actually coating that cut surface with herbicide, and it's actually pulling it into the roots. And that'll be really effective, and you can be super selective with that process. The downside is, you know, you probably have thousands of stems, don't you?
Well, it's going to be very time-consuming. There's a lot of it now.
Yeah, there's a couple of other ways that you can get that herbicide directly on those goldenrods. One is using a wick system, mm-hmm. where you actually have the herbicide on a cloth bar that then you pull alongside, and it just hits the taller plants, and so that way anything shorter wouldn't get hit. And another way that we use a lot on Phragmites is to actually bundle up those stems together, tie them together, then you cut above where you tied them, and then you can spray that herbicide on those cut stems. So the same thing as mm-hmm. with the garden shears, that you apply that directly to those cut stems.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Bert. And Peter in Westfield, on to you now.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I'm a surveyor in southwestern Wisconsin, and I've seen many pastures that were really rendered useless by a honeysuckle, multiflora rose, and prickly ash. And I'm just wondering about, you know, livestock management for controlling those. Are there options that you can use to keep your grass growing underneath some of those things? It's a desert underneath honeysuckle. There's nothing growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real big issue. We're having this brush encroachment in many of our grasslands that we're fighting. We're actually just starting a large grant with several other collaborators at the university looking to try to use animals to help suppress some of these woody species. So there are options. Getting them before they're that dense understory is obviously the key goal there. So if you can get to it when there's just a few plants that are starting to show up, it's really easy to remove individual plants either manually yep. or with a selective herbicide that doesn't harm those grasses. But when it's really well established like that, it becomes much more of a challenge to go in, because basically it involves some mechanical and as well as herbicide costs, and those can be in excess of $1,000 per acre.
Yeah, I mean, you need quite a machine to take care of a multiflora rose that is 30 feet tall and 20 feet across. I mean, I've seen them that significant.
Wow.
I'm curious about intensive pasture rotation, whether that is something that would manage beforehand, helping keep those from getting established?
Yeah, certainly that's, having an intensive rotational grazing pasture. We have had reports that that is an effective way to prevent those brush from even showing up. And we've also looked at high-intensity grazing, where we're putting a lot more animals in there, and that's likely to cause more physical damage and prevent those from even showing up. There's also a lot of interest in goats, and goats will actually feed on preferentially a lot of those woody species and can cause some suppression. So integrating some goats in there, but it seems like everyone I talk to either loves or hates goats. There's no in between.
They're kind of a scorched earth policy. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Thanks so much. I know in California they're being used extensively.
Yes.
There are some goat herds that's why they exist.
Absolutely, and I think that's starting. We now have several consultants. I can think of two or three that actually you can go and rent goats, then bring them on your property, and then you can have them suppress some of the woody species. It's not cheap. I think the key is to grow that industry so that they can then sell those goats for meat and other resources, mm-hmm. and that would make it a lot cheaper. But the industry is just very small still in Wisconsin.
And if you are going to be going with that, then you need to get on their schedule well in advance. They're generally booked up with their herds well over a year in advance.
Wow. That's amazing, isn't it? Doug in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, another great program.
Thank you.
We've got garlic mustard in the woods, and I understand the advice is to cut the heads off because it's a biennial, and it'll die off the next year. But we've been told that the plants will continue to make seeds even after you cut the heads off. So we started pulling the garlic mustard, and then at the garden center, they told us that if you pull the garlic mustard and you pile it, the piles get warm, and that actually makes the seeds germinate faster. So then we thought we'd burn it, but then I saw a flyer from the extension that said if you burn it, it makes the seed pods pop. So I'm wondering about all of that.
Okay, so there's a couple of things here. If you've got a small enough population, hand pulling is definitely the way to go. And ideally, you do that before the flowers have actually opened. If you do it before the flowers open, then you can throw the plants up into the shrubs and let them dry out, and you're not going to have to bag them up and get them out of there. If you do it after the flowers have opened, garlic mustard plants, you can take a big batch of them, put them on your driveway in the full sun, and they will keep growing. And they will keep growing up to the sun, and the flowers will develop into seed heads. So that's why you need to get them into the garbage, get them into, dry them out, burn them, something like that. If you get them before they've developed their seed heads, then you dispose of them in one of those ways, you're not going to have a problem. If you wait until this time of year, you waited way too long. I mean, the seeds are already dropping now. And as far as cutting, yes, they will resprout and they will send up new flower stalks if you do cut. So you need to be careful of that. And sometimes it's just, you're just not able to hand pull everything. So mowing sometimes is more effective, but you may have to go back in and mow again.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for the advice. Now I know how to attack this thing next year.
Yeah. All right. There you go. Yeah. Thanks, Doug. Thanks a lot for calling. Taking a look at invasive plant species today with Kelly Kearns of the Department of Natural Resources and Mark Renz of University of Wisconsin Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lenzer, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at invasive plants with Kelly Kearns. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the DNR. Mark Renz, extension weed scientist at UW-Madison. He's also housed in the Department of Agronomy. So great to have them both with us. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, the Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. You guys have something, a program you're getting started or have gotten started called First Detectors, if I'm not mistaken. Mark, what's that about?
Yeah, it's the Wisconsin's First Detectors Network. And what we did is 2 years ago, we decided to develop formal training where we could train individuals that were interested in going out and looking and educating themselves about invasive species in general, not just plants, but plants, animals, insects, diseases, the whole kit and caboodle. They can sign up for this program, get some training. We do online trainings. We have live trainings over the summer, and they can be part of a network that helps the overall good of detecting some of these new invasive species so we can really get a jump start on what's going on. Because the real problem in Wisconsin is we're losing a lot of staff that's surveying throughout the whole state for these invasive species. So we're going to need to rely on citizen scientists. And so that's what we're trying to do, is develop training programs for them, bring them into a network where we can coordinate them and help us improve our knowledge of where these plants and animals that are invasive are and aren't, because that's really the goal here.
And there have been so many times today when people were wondering, what do they look like or how do we learn more about it? This would be, and sort of selfishly speaking, a way for an individual to learn more.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have about 100 members in this First Detectors Network right now. They're out and about right now doing several things. They're monitoring for invasive plants, as well as doing an interesting survey to help with emerald ash borer, to see where emerald ash borer is and isn't. It's a Cerceris survey, and they're just a great group to work with. And if any of your listeners out there are interested in being involved in this, it's a $30 one-time fee. And as long as you keep up with the 24 hours of volunteer work a year, you don't ever have to repay that cost.
All right.
So it's a good deal.
For $30, that's a pretty good deal. And we should. And where do we go again to?
If you just Google Wisconsin's First Detectors Network, I'm sure it'll pop up. It's fyi.uwex.edu/WIFDN or WIFDN.
So, yeah, we'll never remember that. So
yeah,
Wisconsin
too many letters.
First Defenders, our detectors program, probably the way to go. And Cheyenne, I know Cheyenne's busy on the phone, but we'll try and get that put up on our Facebook page, too, the link, so people can just go right to it off our Facebook page. I'll talk to her about that. She's busy with all the people who are calling in, which is a good thing, too. Fran in Columbus, it's your turn. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I have a question that's similar to the one you just dealt with garlic mustard.
Okay.
Only mine deals with wild parsnips. We have quite a lot of wild parsnips in our prairie, and they are now blooming, of course. And we're wondering, if we chop them out now, can we leave the plants in the prairie, or will the seeds continue to mature? Do they need to be hauled away?
If you're cutting off the seed heads before they even start producing seeds at all, so in the very early flowering stage, you can probably drop those there and they'll be okay. If they're starting to develop seeds, their little green seeds starting to form, I would get them out of there. So take a wheelbarrow along with you or something, just drop those seed heads into that wheelbarrow.
Okay.
And if you mow, there's a chance that you might get reflowering later in the year, and so you really will want to go back in and monitor for later, a little bit later.
Okay, yes, we have had that happen. So we tend to try to chop the roots with a shovel when we go through.
Yeah, Fran, that's a great method. And I think we're fortunate with these set of species in the carrot family, like wild carrot, Japanese hedge parsley, and wild parsnip. We have, and I want to emphasize a little more time when it's in getting into full flower that you still won't get viable seeds. So it's you have a little bit more of a window than with garlic mustard. You really have to be spot on. So if you get after it, I know what stage it is at now, and you're calling from Columbus, you probably could drop them, but you don't have much time. The clock's ticking, right, Kelly?
Yeah. And I do want to mention, back with garlic mustard, we didn't talk about herbicide on garlic mustard. If you have a large population, you really are not going to be able to handle that with any kind of manual or mechanical control. You really need to be using herbicide. Best if you do it both in the fall and in the spring, when very little else is up.
There we go. Thanks, Fran.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. And let's see, we have lots of Facebook questions as well. Facebook question from Tim, who said, I really need help with knotweed. Digging isn't an option. What do the professionals use? And I'm sure a lot of them are using chemicals.
Yep.
Mark.
So there's a range of chemicals that are very effective. I want to emphasize, though, that the chemicals are registered for use in specific areas. So it depends where that knotweed infestation is. For example, if it's in a residential area by a yard or in a garden, you have very restricted chemicals versus in a natural area or along a roadside or other areas. I think probably the best resource for Tim would be to go look at the fact sheets that we said from the Learning Store on knotweed. That lists all of the herbicides. And then I'll warn him, there are effectiveness ratings, but some of those herbicides are only registered for use in certain areas. So residential areas, the best herbicide we have is really glyphosate or Roundup is the best option we have.
There you go. And again, just the learningstore.uwex.edu, or just say UW Extension, not weed control.
That's right.
And that's going to probably pop right up. Lewis wondered, what's the best way to kill buckthorn? I'm cutting off the branches so the berries don't spread.
Okay, so buckthorn, and I'm assuming he's referring to common buckthorn, there are male plants and female plants. And so if you have a large infestation, going after those female plants that are producing the berries first is a good idea. But cutting off the branches is not going to get you there. That's just a whole lot of work. You're better off just cutting the entire tree down or shrub, depending on if it's multi-stemmed or not, and then applying an herbicide such as a triclopyr herbicide that's specific for brush control. And you do it at the cut stump label rate. And you're going to want to do that in the fall or early winter.
And we always talk about fall because that's when the plants are really kind of uptaking nutrients into their roots. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and it depends. It's very species specific.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to hear my weed scientist, you know, soapbox speech here is that management is very specific to the individual species. So with many of these perennials, fall is a great time. But with cut stump, you can actually do it year-round and
doesn't
get
matter.
Very good control. Yeah, so it's very dependent on the technique and the
okay.
species, too. And so that's why we've gone through a lot of time and energy to create these fact sheets. So there is a fact sheet on buckthorn that you could pull up off the learning store, and it has all the options and recommendations. And what Kelly said is right on. If you're a resident and want to buy residential triclopyr, it would be the brush and poison ivy killer is the product that you'd want to get off the shelves.
And Bernie wondered if there's a book out, and we talked about this a little earlier, but a book that identifies different kinds of weeds and how to eliminate them. I'm not sure there's a book there, but fact sheets probably are more likely, or is there a book?
There is a book. There are a couple of different things that are out there. The book is from Wisconsin Press, UW Press, and it's called Invading Weeds, and it's by Elizabeth Zarapata, Czarapata. And that's from a number of years ago. It's almost about, I think, 8 or 9 years old now. And so it doesn't have the newer invasives in there. The other thing that people can get a hold of is from the Wisconsin DNR, where we have a little field guide that is actually held together by rings, and there's pages for each species.
And that is a nice one.
Yeah, and it's called the Field Guide to Invasive Plants of Wisconsin. And we actually are in the process of updating that now with a new supplement that we're going to be adding for all the new species that we added to the NR40 list.
And that's got color photos and the whole business. I haven't seen it now for a while, but I'm remembering that it really... You've got the leaves, the stems, the berries, if there are berries. So, and it's the thing I like about it is about just slightly bigger than my billfold, so it's handy.
Yeah. Yeah, and so and there's also a lot of places online you can look for things too. And the Wisconsin DNR Invasive Species webpage, we have a photo gallery of you know, most of the invasive plants, and so you can just go to that photo gallery and kind of scan through and look for the plant that looks like yours. If you know that may be one of the easiest ways to go.
And Lee, let's go to Lee in Green Bay next. Lee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah. Good morning. First, I have a question. Is the wing euronymus or burning bush on the invasive species list?
Yes. We just added that, and so we left a lot. Most of the cultivars, which is what's sold is various cultivars, we left most of them off of the list. So there are exemptions that allow those to continue to be sold. It's only the straight species and one of the cultivars called Nordine that are actually on the restricted list right now.
Okay, and then another question. With I know that the wild grapes are really getting out of control. There's a product on the market called Kilzol, 41% glyphosate. How detrimental is it to the environment if you're using a product that's on the shelf? You know, anybody can buy it when it's 41% glyphosate, if you're careful.
Yeah, so Lee, that's a great question. And so that's the concentrated formulation of glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And so typically, if you were to be spraying this as a foliar application, like to the leaves, you'd be diluting that to a 1% to 2% solution. So you'd be applying much less. Now, there is also the option of doing what's called a cut surface or cut stump treatment, which Kelly earlier described, where you could potentially put the concentrated solution. But in that situation, you're just applying it just to that cut surface. So it's a real, real small area, and you can be supremely selective, as I like to say. Maybe get a paintbrush and just paint on a little bit on that area. So pretty environmentally safe, but obviously dependent upon how the user utilizes that. You know, as it, we do need to be cautious.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Green Bay, hello.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I don't think there's going to be time before the noon break to cover what I want to do. Can I hang on?
Sure. We'll pick you up after the break. And in the meantime, why don't you ask the question and then we'll get to it.
Well, I want to talk about the Phragmites defoliation program that the DNR instituted back in 2011 along the shores of Green Bay and Lake Michigan.
Uh-huh. What's your opinion?
I think it went horribly badly, and now we have a lot of algae-infested and choked-out areas that were formerly large stands of Phragmites that were being used by the wildlife, and now there's fish kills in shallow, warm waters where formerly there were shaded, cool waters for the young of the year to hang out.
All right. Well, that is something we can give our experts a chance to think about that before our news break. So, Mark, thanks for that question, and we definitely will get to that. Also, Cheyenne was reminding me that the UW Extension Learning Store link is up on our Facebook page. We're going to put that First Detectors program link up on our Facebook page as well, or she might already have it up there. No, she doesn't. She's shaking her head no, but she'll have it up, I bet you, by the time we're done with our news. Talking today with Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Mark Rentz from University of Wisconsin Extension. He's a weed scientist there. Kelly specializes in invasive weed species, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30. News is next. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And boy, we turned our attention today to invasive plant species, and we've been getting a great response from you and lots of people calling in with questions or comments about how to control invasive weeds. And what to do about it, either chemically or if we can get away with it, how do we do it without having to apply chemicals? Two guests for you, Kelly Kearns, invasive plant coordinator for the DNR, and Mark Rentz, associate professor, extension weed scientist at the UW-Madison in the Department of Agronomy as well. So it's great to have them both with us. Hopefully we'll be able to get them back on somewhat of a semi-regular basis to talk about these things, because I'm inundated virtually every week. Hardly a week goes by, but what we aren't talking about how to get rid of one invasive species or another. So join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got lots of those, and I want to get to more of those Facebook questions and comments and the emails as well. But Mark in Green Bay called before the news and wondered about the DNR program to defoliate or get rid of Phragmites. He was not happy with the result. You probably weren't all happy with how everything turned out with that program either, Kelly, but talk about the program and from your perspective and try to answer his concerns.
Sure. So Phragmites is a very large wetland grass, and it's native to all parts of the world, all the continents except Antarctica, as far as we know. There is some form of Phragmites, and we've gotten a pretty good idea now of what is our native Phragmites and what's our non-native Phragmites. You can actually distinguish it from looking at various characteristics on the plants. And the Phragmites, it's all over the Green Bay area. In fact, all over the whole whole shore of Lake Michigan, for the most part, is the non-native Phragmites. It forms very, very dense stands, and especially up in the Door Peninsula, up in the Green Bay area, it covers acres and acres and acres of very dense stands with really not allowing anything else to grow in the area. These plants can get easily, 8, 10, even 12 feet high. And so it's not good wildlife habitat. However, it is vegetation anyway. But so there's been a major effort to do some control in that area, and particularly on private lands where people wanted this done. There's been a lot of people up there wanting control done on their properties and on some of the state natural areas where we're trying to restore some of our wet meadows and other shoreline mm-hmm. communities. And so a very large project was undertaken using some federal funding to do helicopter spraying of the Phragmites, mm-hmm. Where they actually went through and using an herbicide called Habitat, where they went through and sprayed it in for a couple of years in a row. For the most part, it's been fairly successful, and that they've gotten pretty good control, and they've gotten back the native vegetation that they wanted to in many of the areas. In some areas, there's other non-natives coming in, such as purple loosestrife. That happens in some cases. And in other areas, some of the Phragmites is coming back, and so they are going to be going back and doing some more control on it. I can't speak specifically to Mark's concern about it being taken over by algae and
it's
how it's affecting fish spawning.
Usual thing at all. I don't think.
No, I mean, it depends on how deep the how wet the site is. Most of the areas being controlled were a little bit more drier sites. They weren't just right in the water. But the water level has increased this year, and so that might be, part of what's happening.
Okay. So mixed results and...
Yeah.
But
and
you
that
gave,
happens
gave it a shot.
Species control work.
Gave
yeah.
it a shot.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Mark, for that question. I want to give some other callers a chance to get in as well. Kim and Monroe up next. Hi, Kim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I tell you, it just drives me crazy to listen to this stuff because goats eat all of it. Goats don't eat Phragmites if it's on dry ground. Garlic mustard, if we can get the goats on them when the seed pods are green, they will strip all the seeds off, and they're digesting those seeds. But you've got a seed bank, so you have to do that year after year. But each year, you should have less garlic mustard. Buckthorn is their favorite plant. They strip the bark. They strip the leaves. Honeysuckle, same thing. Multiflora rose, that plant is 18% protein, and they will eat every part of it that they can. What else you got out there, Larry? Oh, yeah, we did. Someone asked, will they eat Japanese knotweed? I've never had a job with that. But I told them, the goats were in Naperville, Illinois, at a park. I said, cut some, take it over there. They did. The goats ate it. They will strip out a lot of stuff. And when we use goats instead of herbicides, well, first of all, there's no danger that in a few years someone's going to say, oh, by the way, that causes cancer.
Yeah.
And in addition, what we're doing is we're rebalancing the ecosystem. We're bringing back something that was missing. And one of the things in some environments that's missing is, several million bison. They
yeah.
used to sweep through the prairies and take everything. And that is part of what built these environments. And then large herds of elk. When I lived in Montana, when the elk in winter, the herds were huge. They came together. They don't stay in small groups like the white-tailed deer. At least they didn't in Montana. And that's another animal that they think was creating the oak savannas.
Yeah.
So
goats.
You use herbicides, you're not solving the problem. You're treating the symptom.
Well, what do you think, Mark?
Well, I think Kim brings up some really good points. And I think that that historically there was a lot more ungulates on the landscape that were grazing, and they were grazing in these high intensities like she described, and getting more grazers, and it's a great resource. And I think it is a tool that does have a fit on the landscape. I think that one of the biggest issues that we need to consider when we're selecting a management option is price. And,
yeah.
and effectiveness. And grazing is going to be a multi-year approach. We've seen tremendous benefits. We've done grazing programs, not with goats, but with cattle, and found that they can suppress Canada thistle if you put them at high enough densities. So grazing is a good solution. goats are a part of the equation. We don't happen to have a lot of goats in the area, but they are an option. But it tends to take multiple years, yeah. And so you need to have that built into whatever your management plan is. Herbicides tend to be a lot more cost-effective, particularly when you have widespread populations,
yeah.
too. So, I'm not disagreeing with Kim. I just say it's a more complicated and more nuanced situation.
Yeah. And Kelly, you've worked with goats or had been
not
involved?
Not directly, but certainly I've worked with people who have used goats. And most of the times they're very happy with them. Oftentimes they need to have the goats come back, two or three years in a row. And the problem is that you have to have a kind of a landscape that can fit it. I mean, most urban homeowners aren't going to be able to bring goats in to deal with their garlic mustard in their backyard. And so, if we had a lot more goat grazers out there, then that would be really helpful. The goats can eat a lot of things that cattle won't eat. And so they can be very effective. Sheep as well can be very effective as well.
And there's probably a place online where you can go to, or say, goat grazing or businesses that graze goats or something?
Yes, and we do have a list of restoration consultants that we maintain for DNR, and I have Kim as well as the other goat grazers in Wisconsin on that list.
So it's at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website?
I don't know if it's on the website or not, but people can contact me and we can get it to them. And anytime you're going to be contacting the DNR about anything invasives related, it's best to just use the invasive.species@wisconsin.gov email address. That's a good way to report any like prohibited invasive plants that you've run across, or if you have specific questions, then you can use that, and we'll get back to you on that.
So it's Wisconsin dot...
No, just invasive.species@wisconsin.gov.
Invasive.species@wisconsin.gov.
Yes.
Oh, that's a mouthful, but you know what? It can work. Kelly, or Kim, thank you. Appreciate we lost her there. I bet she's probably got a website of her own up there, a Facebook page. I wouldn't doubt it. Wouldn't doubt it. But we lost her. Bob in Land O'Lakes, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Sure. with the cuts that the governor's done now with the DNR, we have like nobody at boat landings paying attention to boats moving from infected waters to non-infected waters. And it's like 50% of our lakes up here now have invasives, Eurasian milfoil and others. But I was wondering about the idea of having the state licensed boats for exclusive use on, if they're using them on infected waters, that they're not be allowed to be used moving those boats onto infected waters, because this is going to be the only way to control this. And so people would either have two boats, or there'd be a fine if their licensed boat is found on uninfected waters and it was licensed for infected waters, something like that. What do you guys think of that?
All right.
Interesting idea. I don't know that that's been proposed at all before, and I have a feeling that there would be a lot of boat owners that would not be real pleased to know that they can't take their boat from one lake to just any other lake that they want to go to. And so I have a feeling it probably wouldn't get a lot of support from boat owners, but it is an idea that, certainly would be worth...
I've not heard that idea. Maybe it's, you should shoot a note, Bob, to... Where would you, if you wanted to...
The Secretary of DNR. She likes getting comments like that from people like this. If people have good solutions...
directly to her.
Go straight to the Secretary of DNR. She really likes hearing from the public.
So I encourage you to do that. It's certainly been an interesting idea, and one I had not considered and thought of. Well, there's... tell you what, in this world, there are millions of things I haven't thought of. So that's not the first one. We had a Facebook question from Mary. We have a lot of creeping bluebell in our flower beds, which I just discovered is a restricted species. Do we need to remove it?
So a legally restricted invasive species does not have to be removed. There's two different categories under the NR40 invasive species rule. There's a prohibited category and the restricted category. Prohibited are the ones that are brand new to the state or not even in the state yet, as far as we know. And when they show up, we really want to get rid of those. Those you do have to remove. However, the things like creeping bluebell, garlic mustard, all the things we've talked about today, wild parsnip, those are all on the restricted list. And that means that you can't bring them in, you can't move them around, you can't give them to a friend, but you don't have to remove it if you've got it on your property. Creeping bluebell is a really difficult one to get rid of. It has leaves that stay low and grow underneath the vegetation. It's flowering right now in the southern part of the state. Looks very nice when it's flowering. However, this plant is really tough to get rid of, mostly in urban areas. Mark, however, has gotten rid of it in his yard.
Yeah, I had a square meter area surrounded by cement, and I just took the top foot of soil and dug it up and removed it and got rid of all that soil, and that effectively eliminated it because there's seeds in that soil, there's perennial tissues, and it's just really a challenge, as Kelly said, to do any type of management. And so it's a tough one. So if you're in an urban area, you know, my recommendation would be just to make sure it doesn't spread from where it is, and if you can slowly knock it back by hand pulling and selective other management methods, you can really knock back the populations. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen over a year. It might happen over, I've been living in my house a decade now, and it's well on its way out. So it takes 10 years, I would say.
Peggy in Mondovi has a question that we kind of covered it right away in the beginning of the show, but it's worth repeating, I think. Well, how are invasive plants identified as invasive? Don't all plants come from somewhere? And when do invasive plants become native plants?
Okay, so a native plant is something, generally we look at something that probably got here before Europeans moved into North America. And so an invasive plant, something from Europe or Asia, would not ever be native to North America if it wasn't native here originally. And it may become naturalized, it may become wild, but it would not become native. And so, yes, most of our invasive plants are things, the legal definition of invasive in Wisconsin is not native to Wisconsin. And so the invasive species here are native elsewhere. And elsewhere where they're native, such as garlic mustard, in Europe, it's not a problem at all. I've seen it in Europe, and it just kind of grows as a small little urban weed. And it's being maintained there by a lot of different herbivores that feed on it. And so the problem is that we bring these plants over here without their natural enemies
right.
that feed on them. And that's when they get released and they do very well in some of our environments.
Paul in Kenosha has a question for you. Hi, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about sweet clover. Is it native? Is it considered invasive? There seems to be two kinds of it, white blooming and yellow blooming. Do livestock eat it? Is it harmful to them? Is it considered a weed and why?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, you know, sweet clover has a long storied history in Wisconsin. Warfarin, which many of us know is a very popular drug that was discovered at UW here and has been widely sold, was actually isolated, that chemical, off of hay, which was sweet clover in Wisconsin. So historically, sweet clovers, and we do have a yellow and a white, has been planted across the landscape in Wisconsin, very widespread.
It was included in lawn seed mixes, wasn't it?
I don't know if it was. It was more like for the pastures and for the agricultural fields. And so what happened is alfalfa became the more desirable forage. Very few people kept planting it for a feed source for animals. But the seed persists a long time. It was sold in wildflower mixes as well as a range of other things. So I would answer, you said, is it good, is it bad? I would answer yes to all of them. It has a lot of benefits. Talk to our bee industry, and they will describe it's excellent for making honey. Probably their, Kelly, would you agree, their number one source for honey and nectar. But it also is highly invasive and is invading a lot of our natural, pristine grassland prairies. And one of the big issues is once they're in there, it's extremely difficult to eliminate them because of that hard seed that we mentioned, too. Mm. So I would categorize it. It's definitely an invasive plant. It's got a lot of benefits, too, that's used in the agricultural community as well as other communities.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. And I think Karen, to go along with that, Karen in La Crosse has something that relates to what you just said. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Yeah, it does. It relates quite a bit. I noticed an autumn olive growing on my property last month in bloom, and I went up there with a chainsaw, and it was just covered in bumblebees, and so I ended up not cutting it down. And I've also seen what I think are Canada thistles that the bees and the butterflies seem to really love them, so I'm a little conflicted about this. I guess it's the same question you just answered, though.
Sure. Well, certainly some of our non-native plants and even some of the invasives do provide some benefits for pollinators or other insects. However, they're not required for them. The insects that we have here that are native insects evolved with native plants. And so as long as we also have those native plants on the landscape, then there will be plants for those insects to feed on.
Right, as long as they also have the native plant.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
And there have been, not a lot, but a few studies, and those studies have shown that when given the choice, in most cases, I want to emphasize not all of the time, but in most cases, these insects or animals do better off of the native source than the non-native source.
Oh.
And so if you can really promote those native sources of pollen, nectar, probably going to be better off in the long run. But, you know, they're just utilizing what they can to survive. So it's not a surprise at your observations.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen. Yeah, appreciate the call. Randy in Sauk County. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I haven't heard anybody talk about a couple things, but at the time we had a big pasturing culture in our family. I had 30 acres of pasture, and probably 15 of it was, I mean, rendered useless by a combination of prickly ash, burdock, and really what we call bull thistle. I think it's what you call Canada thistle. It's the big, huge red bloom thistle.
Yeah.
And prickly ash was so big, I showed it to my extension agent, and he suggested a cure that we went at over the next 2 years, and that's been 30 years ago, and very little of any of these three are back. And I'm glad he prescribed it. What he did was, he said, first of all, you gotta basically get some leather clothing and get underneath that prickly ash and sever it from the ground. But then we painted each stump with agricultural Roundup and crop oil. And as we would clear an area, that area would stay clear. The problem with cutting these things normally is they just keep coming back, and you go...
Yeah, you go... It's a problem that way, and because we're starting to run out of time, I'm going to break in here for a comment from Mark.
Yeah, well, I think you got great advice from your local county agent. You know, that's what we call the cut stump or cut surface treatment. It can be very effective. The biggest downside to that is... it takes a lot of time and energy, and if anyone knows prickly ash, you don't want to be crawling around underneath it. It's not a pleasant task to do, but that's a very effective way and one of the most common ways for tackling brush species.
Yeah, but you've got to be like Randy and willing to get in there and really
that's right,
and really do the work. Randy, thanks. I'm sorry we're running out of time here. I want to get back just to mention near the end here, we did put up something about the Wisconsin First Detector Network, and in 30 seconds, tell us about that network again.
Yeah, it's a network of volunteers that you can receive some brief training on how to identify invasive species, not just plants or animals, and we give some background training on what an invasive species is, why is important, what are we doing. A lot of the questions we went over today we go about. It's an online training that you conduct, and then you have a requirement of 24 hours of volunteer service where we ask you to just go out and look for things and report them. And we've got a great app at reporting if you find an invasive plant. It's called the Great Lakes Early Detection. It's a mobile app for Android or smartphones where you can be out on a walk, take a picture, send it in, and we will verify what that species is.
And that's the Wisconsin First Detectors program, and we have a link to it on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, or just type in Wisconsin First Detectors program. It's going to pop up. Mark and Kelly, thanks so much. I hope we can do this again soon.
Yes, this is good.
Yeah.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure.
Mark Renz, Associate Professor, Extension Weed Scientist at the UW-Madison. Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plant Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have them along. Thanks for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.